The atmospheric pressure developed on a saucer of 65 feet diameter is over 3,000 tons. In the case of a saucer with a diameter of 200 feet, the pressure developed would be some 30,000 tons. This, therefore, is a tremendous source of power, unequaled by any other natural phenomenon. Otto Dagerich of Magdeburg was the first to notice the tremendous pressure of the atmosphere. It was in 1654 that he tried to pull two hemispheres apart in which he had created a vacuum. Not even the strength of 16 horses could achieve this. Before this, he had seen atmospheric pressure crush a copper boiler in which the pressure was low like a piece of paper. The movement of the air in the upper layers of the atmosphere supports this incredible pressure. If it were not for these, we would be crushed by the volume of gas above us. It should be perfectly feasible to construct a saucer on Earth. Its covering could be made of any material, as there would be no friction with the atmosphere. They could be any shape, although the saucer shape is the ideal one, since one half can take the full force of the atmospheric pressure, while the other is immersed in a vacuum. The speed and maneuverability of a cube-shaped craft would be impaired owing to air resistance on its sides, which would consequently be subject to friction. Unfortunately, a craft of this type could be used in war, but it would also revolutionize our transport systems if it could be constructed on Earth. Distance would not be a factor. Ships and trucks could be dispensed with, as loading and unloading could take place anywhere without having to build special ports or landing fields. Dino Crasp had in a standard transport saucer, this pressure would be much greater. With a craft of 100 meters diameter, we would get a thrust of 78,540,000 kilograms. And with one of 200 meters diameter, the thrust would be 314,160,000 kilograms. There is no limit to the size or capacity of these craft. We construct big cargo carriers up to 600 meters diameter with a payload of almost 300 million kg. This is more or less theoretical because we never use the whole cargo carrying capacity of these giant freighters. If we did so, we would not have sufficient force available to develop high speeds. When we undertake any interplanetary journey, we use a low-capacity craft. The size depends on the object of the visit. Generally, saucers with a diameter of 20 meters are the handiest. These craft, fully equipped, weigh 250,000 kilograms. The total capacity of this craft would be 3 million kilos. But we use this margin of power to enable us to operate at high speeds. A ship could never develop energy on this scale. Not even atomic energy can compare with the forces of nature. And nature does it without poisoning the atmosphere. Is it clear to you now? Q, I understand. What an extraordinarily simple process. A, yes, it is simplicity itself. It is just a question of knowing how. But it would not be complete unless I told you how we set about creating a vacuum externally. First, I will explain to you how the saucer is steered. We can move this vacuum in any direction. Course is set by operating an ordinary lever on a hemispherical mounting which moves the vacuum in the required direction. If we wish it to go in a particular direction, we produce a vacuum on that side of the saucer, and immediately the atmosphere produces a pressure on the opposite side pushing us in the direction of the vacuum. Let us imagine that we are moving in level horizontal flight. If we wish to make a right-angled turn, all we have to do is move the vacuum to the top, or to one of the other sides, and we shall move at the same speed in the new direction. We can change direction abruptly and do not need to describe curves. Do you understand now? Q, yes, I see the whole import of it. This can revolutionize all our concepts of aerial navigation. It is a diabolical piece of machinery. A, it depends on the use to which it is put. I still have faith in humanity and promise that if one day you can agree to abolish war, I will personally come and help you achieve these results, and other more important ones. I shall teach you how to make life a paradise. But as I was saying, we create a vacuum and, to use your words, a diabolical thrust. Friction, however, does not arise as we are always moving into a vacuum. And without friction, the craft does not heat up. We often need extra heating to keep ourselves warm, because the vacuum causes a drop in temperature. There are no technical difficulties involved in producing an external vacuum. You know that cathode rays have the strange property of decomposing the atmosphere through which they pass. Under the action of these rays, the elements of the atmosphere revert to their etheric state. In addition to this, we make cathode rays intersect the anode rays at an angle of 45 degrees. This we achieve by using high voltage and current. Q, where is the cathode ray apparatus situated? A, all over the peripheral area. That is to say, the whole of the outer edge of the craft acts as a cathode ray emitter. These rays are deadly and can only be projected outwards. If a human being were to be exposed to rays as powerful as the ones we use, his cells would be destroyed, and he would suffer lethal burns. But inside the craft there is less radioactivity than in the air that is breathed on Earth. The coloration that saucers appear to give off in flight is caused by these rays. The same thing happens in a Crookes or Geissler tube, an early gas discharge tube. They are a result of the low pressure or vacuum that we create. If we wish to go very fast, we use an absolute vacuum, and move through space in a flash. At other times, we use a semi-vacuum, and we move more slowly. The intensity of the vacuum is proportional to the current used and is controlled by a rheostat. If we want to follow an undulating course, we use a pulsing current. When we are using a semi-vacuum, you observe a luminosity around us at night. But if we are using an absolute vacuum, we become invisible because light does not exist in a vacuum. This is the reason why people always say that we appear to be stationary and suddenly vanish and appear in another spot. A diminution of the pressure in cathode ray tubes causes the light in them to disappear. Light, therefore, is an atmospheric effect, and if it were possible for us to live in a vacuum, we would be in darkness. Dina Kraspeden, I must admit that other methods are also used, such as the bismuth system, which is still used on some craft to set up a difference of energy potential. In fact, this was the system we used to use at first. The captain described this other process to us, but as it was a complex one, we would rather not repeat it here. After having traveled around for some time in these bismuth grates, a being from another planet explained to us how to use a simpler method. Now they are only used for space travel by enthusiasts as a kind of sport, just as you still use sailing boats. That, my friend, is how you can make a craft as fast as, or even faster than, a flash of lightning. Q, I fully accept the explanation you have given. Of course, a craft which could create an external vacuum should have great maneuverability, motive power and payload. It appears to me, however, that this system would not be very good for getting away from the Earth. It is easy to maneuver as long as there is atmospheric pressure. But at a certain height, unless our calculations are basically wrong, this pressure goes down to nothing. I would like you to talk frankly about the method you use to escape from the Earth, because what you have told us so far is only part of the answer. A, you are forcing me to elucidate a vital point, which I would have preferred not to tell you. Once you know this, we shall no longer have any security and would run serious risks due to man's innate love of conquest. But no one can refuse to tell the truth when he is asked. I will tell you everything, but you must promise to keep secret the means by which we produce this force. Q, does this mean that I am not to tell it to other people? A, of course. If there were nothing in what I have to tell you, I would not be imposing conditions. But you must use your own judgment. I cannot forbid you passing on to others information which could contribute to the well-being of the community. But I insist that the information that I give you concerning means of destruction must be kept for yourself only. What I want to tell you could bring destruction even to us, as it would make it possible for you to reach our homeland. The menace that hangs over the world as a result of human technological development would be upon us, and it might turn men into devils. If you approve of the other things I tell you, you may talk about them and carry them out. And if at any time any technical difficulties should arise, I shall be ready to help you solve them. It is sufficient for you to call upon me in thought, and I shall know, even at a distance. Friendship does not impose conditions, and generosity ought to be our universal motto. I also ask you that if one day you should want to make use of this information for the good of the world, you should first tell your own people, as the Brazilians are not aggressive and abhor war. Do not try to explain the problem to anyone who could make one of these craft into a weapon of mass destruction. However, if your people do not attach any importance to the information, you should publish it as you see fit. You should do this without any restrictions, so that all men know it and no one nation can gain an advantage over another. Now I will satisfy your curiosity, but first please pay special attention to certain details which I have told you. Around every inhabited globe in space there is an etheric fluid which envelops it and creates suitable conditions for life. It is a temporary habitat, not only for men but also for spirits. No one can escape from it unless he knows how to produce another for his use. Q. A spirit's also caught within this etheric envelope? A. Yes. A spirit inhabiting a planet has a fluid body surrounding it. A spirit who is still bound by matter to any extent, cannot live without it. If it attempts to escape from its particular world, its spirit body leaves it and is reassimilated into the etheric envelope of the planet. Thus, even spirits are prisoners for as long as they are unable to reject evil, and remain ignorant. Many people call this fluid ether, but the label is of little importance. It is a question of words, which does not affect the problem. What is important is to know what it is made of. We could well call it electric fluid, which would be nearer the truth. In electricity there is a negative charge, and a positive charge. In physics we have protons and antiprotons, mesons and antimesons, electrons and antielectrons, matter and antimatter. On Earth we only find matter, yet it is possible to create antimatter. A body made of antimatter would be expelled from matter. The force of repulsion would be unbelievable. There are interplanetary vessels which are composed entirely of antimatter, but the force field created by this means has a terrifying effect on the physical properties of the people traveling in them. For this reason our spaceships are made of matter. Further, we make our own etheric fluid inside the saucer, and by changing its polarity so as to oppose that of the Earth we are repelled from the planet at a speed corresponding to the difference in polarity between the saucer and the Earth. A knowledge of magnetic fields is required. You on Earth do not yet define them correctly, but we know that the magnetic field is made up of the electric fluids of the planet. If we manufacture an electric fluid which differs from the terrestrial etheric envelope, the magnetic field of the Earth no longer affects us, and we enjoy complete freedom of movement. We can change direction in a way that amazes you, we can move at the speed of light and suffer no ill effects. It is a complete breaking of the shackles which bind man. Within the Earth's atmosphere we always use a vacuum system, but when we leave this atmosphere we put the anti-electron producing machinery into action, and our escape velocity is then phenomenal. Without wishing to terrify you, I can tell you that normally we can reach Mars in a matter of minutes, unless there is a breakdown, and then the trip becomes tedious. When you entered our craft I called your attention to the different kind of light inside which did not emanate from any particular piece of machinery, but it was caused by the air itself being luminous. You also noticed an agreeable, almost spiritual feeling of lightness, a state of near levitation, as well as a feeling of great well-being. At that time you were in an artificial etheric atmosphere and not the ordinary Earth atmosphere. When one's eyes are accustomed to seeing the terrestrial ether, the artificial ether appears luminous. Without this artificial ether no interplanetary voyage is possible. If you try to make a journey without this precaution, you would face certain death. The fluid which binds you to your bodies would leave you, and your bodies would instantly be crystallized. This is the mystery of the crystallized bodies which reach the Earth in the form of meteorites. Any body in space without ether undergoes this process, whether it be made of carbon, calcium, iron, nickel, or any other element. After passing out of the magnetic field of the Earth, all we need to do is to create an ether similar to that of the planet to which we are traveling, and we will then be attracted by it. We can create this ether of another planet even on Earth, so that we will be repelled from Earth and attracted to the other planet whose ether is contained within the saucer. On reaching that planet, We need only to change the ether again to propel ourselves once more into space. By this means life can be maintained inside the craft whatever its construction, and at the same time it provides us with a means of locomotion. Q. I think I understand the system, it is rational enough, but the difficulty would appear to lie in making and changing this electric fluid as required. A. You are wrong there. In nature nothing is difficult. Things are only difficult for those who make them so. Let us go back to what I told you about an electron being a wave and not a particle. One of your physicists said, correctly, that an electron is an integration of electromagnetic waves. But an electromagnetic wave can be of positive or negative polarity. If we were to send electromagnetic pulses between magnets, the waves thus produced would create an ether different from that on Earth. A variation in the distance between the plates would bring about a modification in the ether produced. That is what you wanted to know in clear and simple terms. I cannot tell you more clearly than that. Q. Is very much electrical energy required to bring about this effect? A. Everything is relative. On our saucer, the voltage and current are very high indeed. On a small craft used for research, very little current would be needed. Q. Where do you get this energy from to achieve these results? A. There are various means of making it. It can be obtained by turning hydrogen into helium at low temperature and bombarding deuterium with heavier mesons, releasing a fabulous amount of energy, or by using ultra-rays in an acid solution saturated with helium nuclei. The latter process is the most usual. Q. How does the transformation of ultra-rays into usable energy take place? A. If you allow radioactivity to pass through a magnetic field you will get alpha, beta and gamma rays. The first are helium nuclei, the second are electrons and the third are gamma rays which are similar to ultra rays in their electromagnetic content. These three components of radioactivity are related. The ultra rays, or gamma rays, on passing close to helium nuclei, bring about a deformation of space and give birth to electrons until their wave energy is expended. Thus when gamma rays pass through an acid solution saturated with helium nuclei, the newly created electrons gyrate around the nuclei, but the acid prevents them from joining up with the nuclei, and they are collected on plates at the bottom of the apparatus. This provides an inexhaustible supply of energy which requires nothing more than a little acid solution and some helium nuclei. There are, however, other means. On an interplanetary journey something might go wrong with the apparatus we use for transforming hydrogen into helium and the gamma ray collecting apparatus. If this should happen we would turn to solar energy. We would pass it through a tube of coal gas. This gas, with a suitable catalyst, unites with water, turning it into formaldehyde. This product is then oxidized giving us coal gas and water again. In this second process solar energy is turned into usable electric current, which is quite sufficient to meet our immediate requirements, as on interplanetary voyages there is no lack of propulsive energy for the craft. The laws of inertia provide us with the necessary acceleration to reach the planet that is our objective. Q. So that explains the whole operation of the saucer? A. Yes, that is how it moves. We have, however, several navigational instruments, as you were able to see. Supposing you had to explain to somebody how a jet plane moves, you would naturally say that a backward thrust is exerted which impels the craft in a forward direction. That would be true, but inside the plane there are many navigational instruments. If I were to begin to talk to you about the equipment we use for detecting the etheric covering of planets, that alone would take us some 3 hours. The instrument we use for interplanetary communication is also complex. It is based on principles that you already know of, but have not put into practice. The most important scientific discoveries are still to be made in the simplest things. The secret lies in concentrating on the main issue without going into abstract formulae. With a formula you can explain a phenomenon but you cannot discover it. In science we have to try to discover things, even though everything may already appear to have been discovered. To bring formulae into the calculation merely complicates something that was previously simple. How would your formulae help to show that a difference of energy potential could be produced between the atmospheric pressure and a vacuum, thus producing a thrust? If you had discovered this, it would not have to be proved. The craft itself would have been sufficient demonstration. Anything else is academic pedantry. Terrestrial science does not accept anything which cannot be proved mathematically, and is then only accessible to the few. I can assure you that many brilliant ideas have been shelved for the sole reason that their originators were not sufficiently versed in mathematics to supply the necessary proofs. This kills the spirit of research in a world where so much is yet to be discovered. Q. We supposed, hitherto, that the saucer simply cancelled out the effect of gravity. A. You supposed something that doesn't exist. Gravity is no more than a wrong interpretation of a combination of phenomena. Q. What? Doesn't gravity exist? A. It does not exist. What science calls gravity is a question of a difference in the density of bodies. To explain, the smoke of your cigar is heavier than the surrounding air. Yet, it rises as the result of warmth. That is to say, the difference in density is compensated for by the temperature of the smoke. Therefore, two factors are at work which can influence this phenomenon, density and temperature. We can see that a balloon full of hydrogen gas rises, according to the volume of the gas. The same thing happens with helium. That is to say, bodies of lesser density always tend to rise, in the same way that water and oil separate, due to density. Gravity does not prevent bodies of lesser density from rising. Whereas in air, which is of low density, heavy objects fall rapidly, in water more dense than air they fall more slowly. The third factor influencing gravity is the mass of atmosphere and ether surrounding a planet. This can, however, be included in the factor of density. It is wrong to attribute greater or lesser gravity to a planet without knowing the extent of its gaseous mass and the density of its atmosphere. On Saturn, for example, owing to the absence of atmosphere, gravity is considered zero. On Jupiter, which has a very rarefied atmosphere, it is quite different. A falling body has a high initial acceleration and then it collides with the low density of the planet. On Mercury, however, where the etheric covering extends more than 6 oa km, atmospheric pressure is high and gravity is tremendous. The fourth factor influencing gravity is the vertical component of magnetism. However, the attraction it exerts on a body is, with small variations, the same as that on any other body. Thus it is that the speed of fall in a vacuum is constant. However, this attraction is not due to mass, it is caused by the magnetism with which the whole body is endowed. Lastly, we have the energy that exerts pressure upon the universe and penetrates our systems of galaxies, of which I spoke to you earlier. As a body cannot be subject to pressure in all directions, the Earth always shielding it from this pressure on one side, the body feels a difference in the forces acting upon it and falls to the surface of the Earth. This tremendous universal pressure, which is the result of the vibration of God on the infinite point of the universe, is what maintains the atmosphere of the planets. As the atmospheric pressure has the fabulous power we use to propel our saucers, and as the tendency of gases is towards continual expansion, the whole of the gaseous envelope surrounding a planet would expand into the vacuum were it not maintained by constant pressure. When Newton saw the apple fall, he could not guess that in that moment he witnessed the effect of the divine presence in the universe. Thus it is that we move and have our being in God. Gravity is, then, a combination of phenomena and never an individualized force. Q. Why does heat affect gravity? A. Because it reduces the magnetic force of bodies. You can prove that a magnet loses its properties on being heated. As matter is made up of stationary waves, heat has a powerful influence on them. By increasing the frequency of these waves, they begin to give off light. Moreover, it is well known that heat reduces the density of a body. Accordingly, it tends to rise. This can best be seen in the case of boiling water. The warmer water tries to place itself above the cooler, producing currents. We note that heat is a factor which affects gravity, not because it is itself an agent causing the phenomena of gravity, but because it influences magnetism and density. Q. Does this mean that our science is wrong? A. Very wrong. Q. Then all our physics, including relativity, fall to the ground? A. Only the fallacious principles fall to the ground. Others will certainly remain valid. Does it seem strange to you that this should happen? Ptolemy was a genius, but his entire system collapsed like a pack of cards. The same thing happened with Aristotle. In turn, Isaac Newton came up with the physics of relativity, and its days are numbered. Well, what about the curvature of light, observed by Eddington, Crommelin and Davidson during the eclipse of the Sun on May 29, 1919, which formed part of Einstein's theory? A. The curvature of light is not due to the action of the mass of the Sun, but is caused by the magnetic center of the system situated near the Sun. Even within a solenoid you can see that a stream of electrons is deflected by a magnetic field. There is nothing new in this. If light were to be deflected when passing close to a mass, this phenomenon could be clearly observed in the vicinity or planets, let us say Mars, when it is close to Earth. Eclipses of the Moon, for example, would provide the best opportunity for such observation. Nevertheless, this curvature was only seen precisely where the magnetic center of our system is to be found. If there were no repulsion between energy and magnetism, your motors would not turn. Therefore, light is deflected by the magnetic center and curves round the Sun. If you had proper apparatus, you would see that light also curves on the side opposite the center, as though it were trying to get away from the Sun. I wish to imply that the curvature of space is anti-scientific. Primordial space is not relative to anything and has no form at all. It is neither a curve nor a straight line, and it has no dimensions. It is simply space, infinite in all directions. Wheresoever an observer may place himself, he will always have before him the infinite universe. Q. Then no limit can be conceived to matter? A. If in space there should be a point that could serve as a limit to creation, the God would be contained. But God is infinite, and the universe is a point to him. Only a materialistic science could limit creation. If you conceive a limit, what would you then have beyond it? Q. I should say, nothing. A. Truly, you would have nothing. But space is nothing transformed by God. Matter also is nothing. If it comprises anything, it is the divine energy that brought life to space. To you matter is something. But make a stream of cathode rays pass through it and it will disappear from your view. You will only see space. All that appears is an illusion of our senses. Only one thing is real, that is spirit, and that is exactly what earthly science does not admit. Q. It is hard for us to learn that our most cherished concepts are completely at variance with reality. A. Indeed, one of the bad aspects of man is his obstinacy. If I had urged for an eternity, I would welcome the day when someone would enlighten me. Believe me, I am telling you the truth. What pain can anyone feel by putting error aside and seeing the truth? Q. But it is difficult for us to abandon the science of relativity. A. It will be difficult for science, also, to abandon the experiments of Hertz and Fresnel, who settled upon the wave theory of light. However, when science has to explain electronic theory, the wave theory is put aside. When atomic theory is in question, it turns things upside down and says that the electron is a particle, and has recourse to Planck's theory. Before abandoning relativity, first decide whether the wave theory or the emission theory is true. Verify the true speed of light. Determine the action and reaction of the planetary system. Never use two interpretations in one science, in order to explain the same thing. Q. I have noted the factors which you say affect gravity, but there is a case which should be considered. If it is true that the density of bodies affects gravity, on the top of a mountain the air is more rarefied so that iron, for example, being in a more attenuated medium, should weigh more. However, the contrary is the case, the higher one goes, the less it weighs. A. But I told you also that gravity is affected by the mass of ether surrounding the planet. If the weight of the atmosphere, at sea level, is equivalent to a column of mercury of 76 centimeters, For each 10 meters of altitude the column falls about 1 millimeter. Thus, we must consider the pressure which bodies undergo as a function of their density. The lower the atmospheric pressure, the less is the weight. If gravity were a force with its own attributes and it was that which supported bodies in space, it would be rather difficult for earthly science to explain why meteors are maintained in their orbits. Every year Earth collides with millions of meteorites, always in the same month. This means that they are located in one place.